3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh yeah. Alternative news, analysis and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. Only double. Clap your hands.
Good morning and welcome to Thursday Breakfast. It is 7:01 in the morning and I'm glad that it's feeling a little bit warmer today. I'm in the studio with Alice Zakia and Inez. Good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, I mean, I always get like a bit excited to be here still, even after so many months of doing it. A bit of adrenaline, and I'm really looking forward to hearing everything that's going to be on the show today. Now, we have a really important show. We are going to be talking quite a bit about what happened over the weekend at the far right rally. And I just wanted to pay my respects to everyone impacted by those events. So first, we are going to speak with Narita White. And we welcome back Narita White, a Yorta Yorta and Narangeri woman. And today we'll be discussing the racist double standards in community safety law that enable attacks like the one that we saw at Camp Sovereignty over the weekend. Narita is a mother to two boys and also the CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, aka VALS. VALS provides support to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people navigating the legal system, and you can get in touch with them by calling 1800 064 865 if you need any legal support. And a warning to listeners that that conversation later will touch on racism, police violence, and may contain mention of people who've died. So we'll include some support lines when we get to that interview and give you another warning. And after that, we're going to hear from Jay Coonan, who conducts research and policy for the Anti-Poverty Centre, who's joining us for the second part of an interview on Centrelink debt waivers that were announced on the 27th of August. Kristen joined Tuesday Breakfast this week to talk about the impact of Centrelink debt through a family and domestic violence and gendered lens, and Jay joined them to follow up on how we go about building new systems, resolving debt issues in the social security system, and how this could be a really important first step towards that. So-called debts are generally due to errors in the system or unfair, confusing rules. These include partner and parental income tests, complex eligibility for study payments, cuts to Centrelink payments when a small amount is earned from wages, and access barriers for people experiencing homelessness and family violence. A lawful debt is rarely a fair debt. After that, I am really looking forward to this interview between my co-host Inez and Scobie Mackay, who's a journalist, filmmaker, and youth worker known for his work under his handle What's Doing Media. His work focuses on the political extreme, far-right groups, youth justice, and police accountability. And Scobie joins Inez to reflect on Sunday's right-wing March for Australia rally, led by the prominent self-proclaimed neo-Nazi group NSN, which also attacked a First Nations, sacred First Nations place of gathering, Camp Sovereignty. And finally, we're going to hear an interview between Zakia and Marcel Sadat. Zakia, did you want to tell us what that interview is going to be about?
Yeah, of course. It was about the story of Afghan football team, and Marcel Sadat was the former captain of the team. Mm-hmm. After escaping Afghanistan, the players rebuild their lives here in Australia. But football has always stayed close to their hearts. Now the team isn't longer together in one place. And instead, the players or skaters joining different clubs across the country. So I had interview with Mursal Sadat.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And I've been actually lucky enough to hear it already, but it's always nice when I get to listen to things twice and really take in the information. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast. And after this, we will be bringing you the news headlines.
We're talking about ecological thinning and subsidised logging, but we basically mean the same things, don't we, here?
Wherever there are chemical corporations around the world, they're constantly trying to chip away at regulations.
Earth Matters, bringing you environmental and social justice stories, from developments in government and industry to the campaigns and communities that are standing up to them. Earth Matters plays at 11 a.m. Sunday and 6:30 a.m. Wednesday. Turn your dial to 855 a.m. or listen online at 3cr.org.au.
While the headlines have subsided, the nuclear power plant is still not under control, with the spent fuel rods removed from only one out of four reactors.
Law needs to change so that our rights can be recognised, so that decisions in relation to the use and exploitation of our lands is out.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And now we are bringing you the news headlines. Alice, would you like to take it away?
Sure thing. These are the news headlines for Thursday the 4th of September. Neo-Nazi extremists violently attacked Camp Sovereignty in Nam on Sunday, storming the sacred site armed with poles, pipes and branches, and leaving multiple people in the community injured, including two with severe head injuries. In a joint statement, Camp Sovereignty and the Black People's Union condemned the attack as, quote, a brazen display of fascist and racist ideology, end quote, saying the attacks were enabled by police inaction. Perpetrators chanted white supremacist slogans, desecrated sacred fires, and trampled the Aboriginal flag during the assault. Despite the attack, Camp Sovereignty vowed to continue its work promoting truth, healing, and resistance against racism and colonial violence, and are calling for more people to show up to support the camp. The attacks on Camp Sovereignty followed the mobilization of thousands of people across the country in counter-protests against the far-right March for Australia, which promoted anti-immigration and white supremacist rhetoric.
Also in news this week, Indonesian security forces have intensified violent repression of protesters as mass rallies sweep the country. Demonstrations have been held in more than 100 cities since late August over economic hardship, land tax hikes, and eroding democratic rights. Unoccupied West Papua police opened fire on the peaceful rally in Sorong late last week, killing one person, injuring many, and arresting dozens in what rights groups say in a crackdown on pro-democracy voices. Activists said that these protests, also sparked by economic hardship, systemic violence by police and armed forces, indigenous lands rights, and opposition to to mining and deforestation have united struggles and raised Papua into a nationwide movement. Human rights advocates are calling for international scrutiny, including a fact-finding mission by the Pacific Islands Forum and the United Nations. As President Papua Sub-NATO faces growing unrest and accusations of authorization.
Also in headlines, the Global Samud Flotilla, the largest maritime mission to Gaza in 18 years, departed Barcelona early this week, carrying humanitarian aid and advocating for an end to Israel's blockade. Activists are urging justice, freedom, and an end to occupation and genocide in Gaza, and many world leaders are calling for a clear humanitarian corridor for the flotilla. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Israel's relentless assault continues to intensify, with Israeli forces destroying homes and shelters, displacing and killing families, including children, fetching water in areas declared so-called safe zones. As Israel expands its genocidal offensive, killing more than 100 Palestinians in just the past few days, humanitarian groups and international observers warn that famine is deepening. In the occupied West Bank, Israel continues its illegal military occupation, injuring at least 13 Palestinians in Ramallah this week, with video footage showing soldiers aiming their weapons directly at civilians and journalists and raiding foreign currency exchanges.
In other news, the High Court of Australia has upheld the visa cancellation of a man facing permanent deportation to Nauru, in the first case testing the Albanese government's harmful and expanded third country deportation powers. Last week, Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke quietly signed a $400 million deal with Nauru to enable the mass deportation of people released from indefinite immigration detention. And currently, the Albanese government is pushing new laws through Parliament that will strip deportees of key legal protections. Advocates from the Human Rights Law Centre condemned the moves, warning they pave the way for mass deportations without proper consideration of personal safety, health risks, or family separations.
Also in news this week, federal agencies are under fire after revelations that gas company Santos kept a major methane leak at its Darwin gas plant secret for years, despite the leak spewing thousands of tons of climate-polluting gas since 2006. Environmental experts and Greens politicians have accused regulators of a cover-up and are calling for full disclosure of advice given to Santos and an independent review of the handling of the gas leak. Santos has now been cleared to keep using the faulty tank until 2050, even as environmentalists warn the leak will worsen climate impact, with a scale of leaking pollutants potentially equivalent to 8,300 new cars on the road every year it is in use.
Finally in headline, Melton City Council calling on the Victorian government to crack down on misleading developer advertising. After residents in the fast-growing western suburb of Mount Atkinson were left without infrastructure promised by the developer, Stockland, such as shops, schools, and public transport. The council says stronger regulation and enforcement are needed as frustrated resident voices concerns over ongoing delays and broken promises in their new communities. These have been the news headline for Thursday, the 4th September. You are listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Hi everyone, my name's Robbie Thorpe. I'm with 3CR Community Radio. Every year we have a subscription drive. It's a way of supporting our organisation maintain itself through the year, and we rely on the support of the community. One way to do that is to subscribe and become a member. Become part of this organisation itself. Get in contact with 3CR. You can go to the website 3cr.org.au or you can ring on 9419 8377. 3CR ensures that our voices, Aboriginal voices, are heard on this radio station. So it's a good way of supporting Aboriginal people as well by becoming a subscriber for 3CR Community Radio.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It is Inez, if you haven't heard my voice. It is the 4th of September at 7:17. And before we go to our next live interviews, we will be playing a song by beautiful legend Uncle Archie Roach. And this is a song called Let Love Rule. So let's take a listen.
When darkness overcomes us and we cannot find our way, although we keep on searching for the light of day, and we hear the children crying and we don't know what to do, gotta hold on to each other and love will see us through. Let love rule. Let it guide us through the night, that we may stay together and keep our spirits calm. Only fools will shun the morning light. Cause love's the only thing that will keep us safe from harm. Oh, I cover up my ears so I cannot hear the voices of hate and the voices of fear. And I cover up my eyes so I cannot see what's happened to this country that used to be free. Let love rule, let it guide us through the night, that we may stay together and keep our spirits calm. Only fools will shun the morning light. Cause love's the only thing that will keep us safe from harm. Oh, you know I love this country, every rock and every tree, the grasslands and the desert, the rivers and the sea. And you know I love the people, wherever they are from. Yes, I love all the people who call this land their home. Let love rule, let it guide us through the night, that we may stay together and keep our spirits strong.
only fools will turn the morning night. But love's the only thing that will keep us safe from harm. May love rule. Let love rule. May love rule. Let love rule.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM, and this is Thursday Breakfast. Now, I wanted to give a little bit of context before we go into our next interview, and that is about the right-wing rally that was held on Sunday. Right-wing protesters were pretty much allowed to walk quite freely on the streets of Nam. And you can really see a big discrepancy between the way that people protesting racism are treated by police and then people promoting right-wing values are treated by police very differently. It was a very hands-off approach from the police on Sunday, and the rally was followed up by violence in an unprovoked attack on camp sovereignty. And I just wanted to read a little quote, part of a statement from Camp Sovereignty and Black People's Union on the fascist attack on camp sovereignty by White Australian March and National Socialist Network. Quote, This was not random violence. These racists launched their attack at the time we regularly hold community gatherings for weekly healing ceremonies. These ceremonies are dedicated to honouring our ancestors, promoting peace and unity and working to heal the wounds of genocide and the deep rift imposed between First Nations people and settlers. To target us at this moment reveals that their true intent is to desecrate what is sacred and to violently disrupt our efforts at collective healing on behalf of racism, fascism, and white supremacy. Their violence disproportionately targeted women and vulnerable people, exposing both their cowardice and the gendered fascist nature of their ideology. While they marched under the guise of opposing immigration, they themselves are the clearest manifestation of the very anti-immigrant propaganda they spew. Violent immigrants who have invaded, dispossessed, and brutalized this land and its people for generations. The reality is plain. If you march with Nazis, you are a Nazi. End quote. Yeah, I think that gives some really important context about the guise of anti-immigration and how so the rally was held under the guise of anti-immigration, but really it is targeting sacred spaces of First Nations people, and so totally undermines that farce. Before our next interview, we are going to another song. And now we are going to hear Move by Baker Boy before we are joined by Narita White, who is going to give us a bit more context on community safety laws. And one more thing before we go into this song. I just wanted to include some support lines, as it's been a really big week. And I know that every day in the colony is punishing for a lot of people. So if you need support, you can call First Nations and Torres Strait Islander support line 13 Yarn on 139276. You can also call Yarning Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-5563. And if you need immediate support, on a general support line, you can call suicide callback service on 1-300-659-467. Now we're going to hear Move by Baker Boy.
Cause I just wanna move, yeah, yeah. And you can come too, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's me plus you, yeah, yeah. So tell me what we gon' do, yeah, yeah. Cause I just wanna move, yeah, yeah. And you can come too, yeah, yeah. And one time for the crew, yeah, yeah. So tell me what we gon' do, yeah, yeah. I know you heard it all before, but I can't find a flaw, and that I can't ignore. Wanna know who you are, you probably get this all the time. You're welcome to decline. Since the minute that I seen you, baby girl, been on my mind. Conversation, R&B on rotation. I'm gonna take my shot, no curve, no hesitation. Finesse, perfect placement, my moves are tight. And I know she approved, cause the mood is right. She the energy I need to make it through the night. And we're dancing like there's not a single soul inside. She drinks a little, but tonight she's a sober type. She loves to speak her mind like it's open mic. I pray to God that this club don't close tonight. I never met a woman like a, she a prototype. No disrespect, you just one of a kind. Got me sprung and you ain't even trying, no lie.
I just wanna move, yeah, yeah. And you can come too, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's me plus you, yeah, yeah. So tell me what we gon' do, yeah, yeah. Cause I just wanna move, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can come too, yeah, yeah. And one time for the crew, yeah, yeah. So tell me what we gon' do.
Nika dua jana mera marchi reunion. Hum bala basketball court is where we going, that is what we doing. Ya nara kajal terngale telangale to bole let you come. Gonna kick it when we get back home. You know I got the good funk, put you in the zone. Cause it's all about Netflix and chill, racking up my phone bill. Every love song got me caught in my feels. Taku no more door, door, gamur kur no more dad. Marga let you come, nanina nitu yaka wargu yun na. While I rally to reminding me na. Just the simple things, living it up. There is nothing that is better than love. I'm just a phone call or text away. When it's time to go, it's late in the day. But you wanna stay, cause I just wanna move, yeah, yeah. And you can come too, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's me plus you, yeah, yeah. So tell me what we gon' do, yeah, yeah. Cause I just wanna move, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can come too, yeah, yeah. And one time for the crew, yeah, yeah. So tell me what we gon' do, yeah, yeah.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And now we welcome back Yorta Yorta and Narangeri woman, Narita White. And today we'll be discussing the racist double standards in community safety law that enable attacks like the one we saw at Camp Sovereignty over the weekend. And you just heard a statement from the Black People's Union and Camp Sovereignty on what happened. Now, Narita is also a mother to two boys and the CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, aka VALS. VALS provides support to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people navigating the legal system. And if you need some support, you can get in touch with them by calling 1800 064 865. And a warning to listeners that the following conversation, which will finish at 7:45, will touch on racism, police violence, and also may contain mention of people who have died. Good morning, Narita.
Good morning.
Yeah, thank you. We really appreciate your time, having you back on the show to hear your insights again. And especially at this busy time.
Always happy to walk through these always complex and difficult moments that we seem to continually be experiencing lately.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to extend support in multiple ways and maybe informing ourselves a little bit about the underlying laws that create this type of violence is a good way to facilitate resistance at all levels. So first of all, Narita, how do community safety laws enforce systemic racism And when we say community safety, whose safety are we talking about?
So the government has been framing their tough on crime reforms under the guise of community safety. And like you said, when they talk about community safety, whose community are they talking about? Is it the whole of Victoria or just some parts of it? Certainly from our perspective, it's clear that this government is really only concerned with protecting the safety of some Victorians, certainly not all.
Mm.
You know, whether we look at the recent amendments on bail laws, introduction of post and boast offences, or the expanding of police powers, all of these approaches have resulted in increased discriminatory and racist policing practices and racial profiling.
Mm-hmm.
And the impact of systemic racism in Aboriginal communities is a direct product of this country's violent racist history. You know, the legal system is built on that foundation of violence and dispossession, denial of sovereignty and humanity, with the colonial project continuing through policies of protection and assimilation. Just the other week, the City of Melbourne initiated a six-month trial contracting private security to address issues of begging and alcohol consumption in the CBD. These are very clearly poverty and health issues.
Yeah.
And that private company hired for, again, community safety have been seen with the thin blue line symbol, which is kind of widely co-opted by white supremacists and far-right groups, particularly as a reactionary symbol against the Black Lives Matter movement. And that just isn't community safety. It isn't a subtle, it's the subtle and sometimes even hidden expansion of racialized policing, which will impact vulnerable and disenfranchised communities. And I also just want to take everyone back to after the referendum.
Yeah.
And even during it, Aboriginal communities saw increasing racism in the schools, on the sporting fields, in everyday life. And we didn't hear anything about that from our leaders,
yeah.
Our so-called political leaders who... It's their job to protect our safety, right? But nothing happened. And I hope this isn't an instance, again, of nothing happening.
Yeah. And I think that really outlines how when you basically debate or make it a public issue, I'm doing air quotes for public, because we're talking about the colony where, you know, the white majority has power and voice. And when you, in something like the referendum, when you put up for debate First Nations people's right to self-representation and right to autonomy, it really is an invitation for people to react against it, and creates a really unsafe political, cultural, social environment for First Nations people, extending out to immigrants and all people of colour. Now, Narita, can you describe some examples of policing at the neo-Nazi rally or the right-wing rally led by a neo-Nazi group? Can you describe some examples of policing that show these racist double standards present in our law?
Yeah, I mean, again, thank you for putting out the trigger warning early, because this part of the discussion can certainly be triggering for some.
Yeah, another warning for people listening.
Yeah, in that 16-minute Facebook Live video and the countless other videos that surfaced online, we saw hate crimes, we saw an act of terrorism on our people and the sacred ancestral lands of our people. You know, this was a site of burial. This was a sign of a site of sacred fire. And these boys, I mean, they're not men, stormed the camp and attacked women mostly, beating our people with poles, kicking with steel cap toes, stamping on, attempting to burn our flag, and seriously injuring four people. They weren't hiding who they are. All the footage shows their faces clearly, when they were yelling, "White man's land."
Mm.
Perhaps they need a history lesson, because certainly the land that they live on is Aboriginal land and always was and always will be. And we also saw, you know, Victoria Police only raided pro-Palestinian activists in their homes that day. Victoria Police only pointed their weapons at pro-Palestinian supporters. Victoria Police chose to chaperone neo-Nazis through the city. In that, any ordinary person looking at it feels very clearly who Victoria Police was choosing to protect and whose safety they were concerned about. And we also saw the Victoria Police were unable to use their expansive powers to garner control or even provide a modicum of public safety. This was a known and planned attack. This was not a surprise. And they should have had community safety measures in place to protect Aboriginal and Torres Strait peoples and camp sovereignty, rather than just pandering to the far right time and time again.
Yeah.
They know who did it and only charged the neo-Nazi leader after he confronted the Victorian Premier Jacinta Allen. You know, and who's to say what would happen if he hadn't done that?
Yeah, and even then, I was really shocked by that video. So the video depicts, the self-proclaimed neo-Nazi leader approaching Jacinta Allen and kind of going into a bit of a speech about, it doesn't even matter, to be honest. But the reaction from security to his interruption was actually to stand back and film him. And it struck me that the reaction was to let him speak. When if that was potentially a First Nations person or a pro-Palestinian activist, you probably would have seen them tackled to the ground very quickly.
Definitely. This goes back to what we've seen our elders, our leaders talk about for generations now, and particularly what's been circling over the last couple of days as we try to grapple with this outright attack and this act of terrorism, is that when we talk about our mainstream political leaders, our governments, they tend to seem to want to us to always be in the shadows, to be hidden, to be less than. But people who present hateful ideology, not just against First Nations people, but of all people that are not white, they get a platform, they get encouraged, they get respect. It's terrific. Sorry.
It's all right. Yeah, it's really, really blatant. The double standards are blatant in every part of our law, on the streets and in the courts.
Now, definitely. If, you know, the Premier was actually serious about everyone's community safety, and when I talk about everybody, I mean, using her own words, all the other people in the community who Nazis target, like multicultural people, LGBTQIA+ people, First Peoples, then the anti-vilification laws would already be in place. Rather than us waiting for the bill to commence on the 20th of September, these laws could have been proclaimed well in advance of this weekend's known and planned protest, and we would have then been afforded community protection.
Yeah.
And this is, in my view, this is just the abhorrent failure to protect our communities. And let's not pretend as though this issue of neo-Nazis within this state hasn't been something that's been on the radar for a really long time.
Yeah, so you touched on anti-vilification laws that are underway. Can you speak a bit more about those laws and what needs to change right now? So, not at the end of the month, but right now.
Yes, Premier Allen really believes her own words that there's no place for hate and fighting for all Victorians' right to belong, then she needs to commence the anti-vilification bill immediately during the next sitting week. It's just next week. She can do that. What we also need to see from this government is actual leadership on tackling racism. Not just the things they like to pick out, but the whole issue of racism. Otherwise, we're going to see these attitudes and behaviours and violent acts continue, and that doesn't make it a safe Victoria for anyone.
Yeah, thank you, Narita. Is there anything that you'd like to leave us with this morning?
Just that I know that in a cost of living crisis where people are worried about putting food on their table, a roof over their head, that it's hard to always keep up with what's going on. And I 100% completely understand that. But we want to all push for a better Victoria for everyone. And I really encourage them to reach out to their local members of parliament who work for them, to also be raising the issue of making sure that we have appropriate laws in place and we have appropriate protections for everyone, not just a select few.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And we will be keeping an eye on the work of VALS and the proposed treaty bill. Thank you, Narita.
Have a
great
day.
Thank you. Bye. We just heard from Yorta Yorta and Naranjeri woman Narita White, who discussed with us the racist double standards in community safety law that enable the right-wing and racism-fueled attacks like the one that we saw at Camp Sovereignty over the weekend. And my heart goes out to everyone impacted by that, which I know is a lot of people and particularly First Nations people. Now, that conversation did touch on racism, police violence, and it was pretty disturbing on multiple levels. We are touching on it again this morning in our interview later with Scobie Mackay. So I just wanted to provide some support lines. If you need support, you can call 13YARN on 139276, and that is for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. You can also call Yarning Safe and Strong on 1-800-959-563. And for a general and immediate help, you can call Suicide Callback Service on 1-300-659-467. And I did say that was immediate help, but it is actually a callback service, and they're usually pretty prompt. So please feel free to reach out to any of those should you need support. This is Thursday Breakfast. It has just hit 7:43 in the morning, and we have some great interviews upcoming. Three more interviews this morning. So you'll be hearing them soon.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Panoply, panorama, panpipe, pansy, aha, pansexual, knowing no boundaries of sex or gender. Sound interesting? Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan. All those gender questions making you think too hard? Whether it's transgender, bisexual, polyamorous or beyond, we'll throw those questions into the pan and cook up the answers for you. So go on, push that gender envelope. Only on 3CR 855 AM digital and 3cr.org.au. Let's cook.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And now we are going to go to our next interview with Jay Coonan and my co-host, Inez Winters.
Thanks so much, Leela. I'll be speaking to Jay Coonan, who conducts research and policy for the Anti-Poverty Centre, who joins us for the second part of our interview on Centrelink debt waivers that were announced on the 27th of August. Now, Kirsten joined Tuesday Breakfast this week to talk about the impact of Centrelink debt through a family and domestic violence and gendered lens. And Jay joins us to follow up with how we can go about building new systems on how to resolve debt issues in the social security system and how this could be a really important step towards that. And a lawful, quote-unquote, debt is rarely ever a fair debt. But thank you so much, Jay, for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Could you briefly discuss what these new Centrelink waivers are and what was discussed on Tuesday Breakfast about the impact on people through a gendered lens?
Yeah, so the government announced on the 27th of August that they were going to put forward legislation and a package totaling $300 million to resolve the issue around income apportionment. And so basically income apportionment is the averaging of a debt through a period which smooths out your pay, and then there were miscalculations, basically, which incurred a debt. So it's an administrative error on behalf of Services Australia, and in order to correct that, the government is going to increase the threshold for waiving debts to $250. And for people who have already paid those debts or are yet to receive them, there is the a resolution payment of up to $600 that you will have to apply for through Services Australia. So obviously what this means is that a lot of people who have incurred these debts going back to 2003 will be able to have them wiped, and particularly when it comes to cases of domestic and family violence where the social security system has been used to perpetuate violence against the partner. The government will also be establishing new powers to allow the, victim survivors of that coercive control to be able to access a waiver of any debts used for that as well. And that kind of does come a bit out of the Robo-Debt Royal Commission, or the government's trying to claim credit for that as well. But, you know, this will also be it will be made more available to people who are impacted by natural disasters, homelessness, and, and the like.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's very important to, contextualise it, and particularly from RoboDebt, which I will, touch on a little bit later in the interview. But I'm wondering, what are the broader concerns about this new debt waivers and why it's not enough? I think hearing it sounds great and wonderful, but I feel like there's often missing pieces, particularly with Services Australia. So I'm wondering if you can speak to that.
Yeah, totally. Look, at first, you always see something like this and you're like, oh my God, a win, finally. But then when you look at the details, you're like, oh, hang on, this isn't actually a win. I mean, like the biggest thing, for example, is, one of the Robo-Debt Royal Commissions was to put back in place a six-year time limit on debt. So the government would not be able to go after debts beyond 6 years old, which was removed during the coalition government. But the government still hasn't done that. And, that would go a long way in order to, protecting people from a lot of historic debts, which we know, for example, they're chasing people to debts, as far back as 1979. And the other thing as well is that in the Minister Plibersek's media release, it says that accidental debt waivers will be increased for the first time in 30 years to $250. And it's like, oh, wow, that's, it sounds like a pretty substantial thing. But if you account for indexation, that figure should be over $400. So it hasn't been indexed to, it's just a small increase, basically. So there's a few things wrong with it. But, when the bill is put into Parliament sometime in the next few months, then, you know, I guess we'll be able to have those conversations and start kind of campaigning around it there.
Yeah, amazing. And I think, yeah, talking about how it is so reminiscent of robo-debt, so many people lost their lives to robo-debt. It was so devastating in almost every way, including the Royal Commission. And, yeah, I guess, you know, speaking from the Anti-Poverty Centre, and you've been doing work from robo-debt to now this Centrelink debt waiver, why does it feel so similar? And I think, you know, even talking about it, I feel like a drop in my stomach a little bit of, like, why is this happening again?
Yeah, so there's a couple key differences between what robo-debt was and what income apportionment is. So just quickly, income apportionment is a bit of a strange story. So it's a very technical thing where there was a line in the legislation going back to 2003. So that's why they put it, reversing these debts or, you know, waiving them back to 2003. But we know, and it's been found out, that the practice of apportionment has been used since 1991, but they don't know how or why they started using income apportionment in 1991. But it's been unlawfully used since 2003. So it's just this confusing, weird story. Whereas robo-debt was where they took your income, what the Australian Taxation Office had, and smoothed that out over an entire year. And then the discrepancies were raised as a debt from Services Australia side, based off of what you declared to Services Australia. So it was a misalignment of data, which was just creating fake debts. So one apportionment, to think of it, is like a bad practice, whereas robo-debt was an intentionally illegal practice.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that definitely helps.
Yeah.
Clear it.
And very confusing, I know.
Yeah, no, I think it's good to understand. I think so much of this legislation and, like, these systems are purposely confusing a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So I think being able to, you know, disseminate and really, break down what each thing is about really helps, particularly for listeners and even for myself as well. And I'm wondering where it's kind of landing in the legislation space. So I feel like has the bill not passed yet? How is it kind of in the works? And why is this being announced now? I guess, like, what's the purpose of this?
Yeah, not sure, to be honest. I mean, you know, it's been, 2 years now since the end of the Robo-Debt Royal Commission, and there have been no changes implemented. This decision about income apportionment is in response to a federal court case, which was obviously separate to the Robo-Debt Royal Commission. In this press release, the government isn't claiming that this decision to waive debts is based on anything to do with robo-debt. So it would be purely down to the federal court case that took place recently. So I guess that's the only thing, but, you know, everybody's still waiting on, what the government and how the government's going to respond to robo-debt, particularly the recommendation around the 6-year term limit for debt.
Yep. And I was looking through the Anti-Poverty Centre's media release and the recommendations that it's calling for. Could you walk us through the recommendations that were listed and, like, yeah, what is the hope from these recommendations?
Yeah, so ideally we would have a social security system that isn't trying to punish and penalise people over the smallest things. So really what has created this is a highly targeted social security system. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the availabilities of payments through tests based on your income, your partner's income, your parents' income, whether or not you have a house, you know, there's all these different hoops that you have to, you know, be assessed on in order to qualify for a payment. And you could have a payment and then enter a relationship and then not let Centrelink know in enough time, and then they take your partner's income and then you incur a debt through that. So there's, like, many things that create debt in the social security system, which just shouldn't exist, and it just needs to be simplified, because debts are coming about by the overcomplexity of the system and also the complexity of when it comes to assessing your income, which is how things like apportionment are developed and so forth. So, you know, like the immediate stuff that we are calling for is, you know, basically to make sure that people's payments are accurate before a debt is incurred, or if a debt is incurred, you know, where a lot of people who are on a payment who receive a debt, they're in no position to pay that debt. So we're asking that the government just kind of like wait until that person has a livable income, if they ever do, in order to pay that debt back where it's fair and found to be, you know, wrongful or whatever. And also to, you know, treat unemployment as a valid reason not to harass people over debt, which is, you know, the ACCC and ASIC debt collection guidelines for collectors also use. So there's just some basic practices that they could establish at Services Australia, and also they could just be like, just make, don't make the social security system complex, make it far much easier, and more people will be able to get help, and there will be less debts involved and less administration too on both the government and the individual.
Yeah, we're definitely hearing a win-win for everybody involved. And I guess when it comes to like actually building a new system, what does that like actually look like, and how can our listeners of this show support this and find out more?
Yeah, we're always open to hearing people's contributions, particularly if you've had a debt, you're with your employment service providers, like, you know, please get in touch with the Anti-Poverty Centre through our website or social media accounts to have those conversations. But, you know, if you have had an income apportionment debt, or you suspect that you have, considering it's going back to 2003, so it's a long time, is there will be a website set up for you to check, and you'll be able to find out through that. And if you're going to be able to access any kind of, you know, payment back from them, or if you have a debt, to also get that debt waived is one way. But, you know, the bill will be coming up in the next month or so, we suspect. So there's also the opportunity to participate in that process to call for much stronger protections like the six-year term limit and the removal of the partner and parental income test as well to, you know, reduce the opportunity for debts to be incurred.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much. And we'll have all the details on how to follow up with the Anti-Poverty Centre in our show notes. But thank you so much, Jay, for being a supporter of the show and coming back and talking to us about this important topic.
No, thank you so much for supporting us on this course. Thank you.
Thank you. And that was Jay Coonan, who conducts research and policy for the Anti-Poverty Centre, who joined me to discuss the second part of our interview on Centrelink debt waivers that were announced on the 27th of August. Now, Kristen from the Anti-Poverty Centre joined Tuesday Breakfast this week to talk about the impact of Centrelink debt through a family and domestic violence and gendered lens. And Jay joined us to follow up with how we could go about building new systems on how to resolve debt issues in a social security system and how this can be an important step towards that. So-called debts are generally due to errors in the system or unfair or confusing rules. Often a lawful quote-unquote debt is rarely a fair debt. You're listening to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. It's currently 8 o'clock on the 4th of September.
Do you have a fine you're worried about? If you are struggling to pay a fine, there can be ways to help you deal with it. You may be able to get your fine lifted or reduced where you are experiencing difficult life circumstances, such as family violence, mental health challenges, disability, homelessness, or drug or alcohol dependency. If you have fines from not paying toll roads, you may also be able to get the fine waived if you're experiencing financial or other hardship. Speak to a community lawyer or financial counsellor to get advice on your options. You can find your local community centre on the Federation of Community Legal Centres website, fclc.org.au. You can find a financial counsellor by calling the National Debt Helpline on 1800 007 007. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenantsvictoria.org.au. www.tenants.vic.org.au, anikalegal@www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855am, and this morning we've heard from Yorta Yorta and Narangeri woman, Narita White, who is the CEO of Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service. After that, we heard from Jay Coonan from Anti-Poverty Centre, and now I'm throwing it over to Inez to introduce our next interview.
Thank you so much, Leela. Really appreciate that segue. And now we'll be chatting to Scooby McKay, who is a journalist, filmmaker and youth worker known for his work under the only handle What's Doing Media. His work focuses on the political extreme, far-right groups, youth justice and political accountability. And Scooby joins me to reflect on Sunday's right-wing March for Australia rally, led by prominent self-proclaimed neo-Nazi group NSL, which also attacked the sacred First Nations place of gathering, camp sovereignty. And we discuss media, political accountability, and interviewing. So thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Inez.
Thank you. Could you tell us a little bit more about the work that you do and why you chose to cover the right-wing rally on Sunday, the 31st of August?
Yeah, I mean, I've been covering far-right movements for a few years now. I started during... basically during 2020 when we saw this uptick in conspiracy theory-led anti-lockdown protests. I was fascinated by them. I wanted to know what motivated people to come down. And I kind of wanted to know where these people were receiving their information and how it informed their beliefs. As for this weekend, this was a massive uptick in mobilization from these sort of freedom movement, freedom protesters. It started from a viral video from an 18-year-old on TikTok and kind of spawned into something much more dramatic and much more radical once it was taken over by neo-Nazis, especially around that organization period in the early days of the TikTok. The National Socialist Movement made their move and took over responsibility of organisation, especially in Melbourne.
Yeah, well, I didn't know about it starting off from a TikTok and then the kind of increase in numbers. Could you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so as far as we know as researchers, the TikTok basically was put out by an 18-year-old kid. It received about a million and a half views, and I think it really tapped into a sentiment in some people in this country that really wanted to show strength and a rejection of the pro-Palestine rally that went across the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
Right.
So I think a lot of people were really motivated by those scenes. They didn't see it as the, I suppose, the Australia that they grew up in or they envisioned. And they saw it as a threat on their identity and their way of life, perhaps. And so it really became this really viral, almost grassroots moment where this young kid caused something that he had no idea would amount in a massive mobilization across the country.
Wow. And I know that you also are like a youth worker and even, you know, as a journalist and a filmmaker, you must, you know, see how technology and algorithmic radicalization kind of contribute to a lot of this. I guess, what have you seen as the trends towards more right-wing sentiments, particularly through your work with, young people and through media? Like, what has contributed to such a large increase?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my work is... pulling kids up on the content that they watch. It's obviously incredibly concerning that kids, you know, sometimes as young as 8 or 9, can have access to voices like Andrew Tate or are aware of people like, I don't know, like Diddy or other, you know, incredibly harmful celebrities that preach really twisted views of masculinity and politics. And so, yeah, it's a constant conversation that I have with the young people about online literacy and being able to distinguish between what is something that should be taken with maybe a grain of salt or with criticism, and something that, you know, is based in fact and reality in our world. And I think that's a conversation that, you know, all people have to have, regardless of if you're a youth worker, with the young people in your life, is being able to give them the tools that they need to distinguish between what's harmful content on the internet and what's not. I think a lot of people don't realise how harmful the content older Australians and generally older people in the world are consuming, and because there's really not that accountability, or there aren't people pulling them up and teaching them because they might be older, they're often the ones that fall into these rabbit holes. And that's why, you know, when you go to a march like we saw on the weekend, it's definitely skewed to the older demographic.
Yeah, absolutely. I think even like recognizing the, from like another sense, like I was there as well, and then also work in social work, and even hear from a lot of my friends who, yeah, work in like family violence, say similar sentiments of you cannot underestimate the role that algorithms play on young men, and how this contributes to so many things, from yeah, radicalization to family violence. But being, I watch a lot of your interviews and from the event as well, I guess reflecting on the day, either from the police or from both sides, particularly from a lot of the double standards or like the confusing politic that the other side had, how would you reflect on, yeah, I guess your reporting or the interviews from that day?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think there's a lot of people that attend those rallies that genuinely believe that they're not racist. They genuinely believe in a multicultural Australia. They want to see, you know, different faces. They want to eat different food. But they're convinced that there's this almost conspiracy of mass migration to this country. And, I mean, migration policy hasn't changed in this country in decades.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the same thing. But they are convinced that there's this conspiracy to, like, replace existing Australians, and for a lot of those people, that doesn't mean necessarily white Australians. It just means Australians that are already here. I think it's an interesting one, because it's like you have this neo-Nazi group, the National Socialist Network, and in a twisted way, at least they're not cowards and they stand up and be like, we are racist. And the, you know, their minions, or the people that are protesting alongside them or attending a protest that's led by them, are still, I suppose, deceiving themselves into thinking that they're not racist, that they don't stand for the same thing that the leaders are standing for, that they're, you know, they're kind of, yeah, arguing for an Australia that doesn't exist or never has existed. And, yeah, I think that's what's really confusing about it all.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what was, I think, really confusing is, particularly from our side, there was, I think, regardless of where people fall, often it's led by an empathy-based politic. And I guess from the other side, I even, like, listening to people talk or the rallies, I was like, what is this politic, or what are the themes that they're actually campaigning for? Because it really doesn't seem to make any sense. I guess even when looking through your interviews, like people that had fought in World War II were happy to attend this rally. And yeah, I guess I'm like, what are the confusing politics or the surprising sentiments that you had from that day talking to people?
Yeah, I mean, it really is all over the shop. And I think that's the problem when movements are led in, you know, major part by conspiracy theories, is that people don't really have a strong grasp of the policy and politics that you know, form the foundation of their ideology. And with this group, it's so disparate, and you have all these different far-right groups. Some of them are libertarian, some of them are fascist, some of them are just, I'm an Aussie and this is my identity and I feel under attack. I think a lot of people there were, you know, probably working class, regional Australians that don't spend that much time in the city, don't spend that much time around, you know, multicultural communities. And the only thing that they see is you know, news reports about crimes and about, you know, a whole different range of trumped up media sensationalism around multiculturalism. And I think, you know, we can typecast it all as far right and push it over as this fringe. But the reality is there are a lot of, while they are receiving a lot of this information from, you know, Telegram and from different online networks that feed this information, a lot of this is coming from mainstream center-right media publications that profit off this sort of sensationalism, but perhaps don't necessarily actually believe in what these far-right neo-Nazi groups are doing, but they just see money. And I think that's what's really sad, is that you have these people out there that are just more or less ignorant about the situation, but they're incredibly fearful. And I think that's what this protest comes down to, is that a lot of people in that protest are genuinely fearful. They fear for their safety. They fear that their identity is being lost or tarnished. They fear for their children. They fear for their, you know, their financial situation. And the very easy explanation for that is that there's this conspiracy of mass migration.
Yeah. I guess even like thinking about the double standard or the sway in politics is also reflecting on the horrific attack on camp sovereignty, who are the first people and the longest living culture here, who were warning everybody about the numbers of how this is and how this colony exists, and, you know, post the referendum. It's kind of has always been there, kind of out in the open, and this attack, particularly the lack of, you know, police accountability and the political extremity of the event. And I guess, what does it reveal to you about the police and the targeting of sacred spaces? Like, this was also a quote-unquote anti-immigration rally, and then you're attacking the First Nations Indigenous people that this land belongs to.
Yeah, I think it probably revealed that Victoria Police very much see the threat of the far right as similar or equal to far left, and they will treat both threat as, you know, two monkeys in a cage fighting each other. And I think that's obviously not based in reality at all. I mean, we're talking about a neo-Nazi organisation here that are actively attacking peaceful people, that are actively trying to, you know, expel, like, completely unassociated with politics, people of colour that just are going about their day and living their life here. This threat is not equal. And I think, you know, Victoria Police in many ways failed on Sunday. They were unable to keep both groups separated. They obviously did not have a police officer or a police commander focused on that neo-Nazi group. They were pretty much able to run wild. And when they left the protest, they walked straight to Camp Sovereignty and attacked innocent people. A lot of them were women. A lot of them were, you know, unable to defend themselves. But I will say this, from the videos that I saw, I wasn't there in the day, but Camp Sovereignty very much held their own. You know, they fought back and they defended that sacred space, which is incredibly commendable to the people that were there. And really brave, because this group of young men are incredibly dangerous.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just, it beggars belief why Victoria Police have not come down harder on this, yeah, group of rogue individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, from sentiments from people who were there and, you know, from videos, it's like the police were standing by and then only came up later and then were, you know, immediately attacking the people who had recently just been assaulted and victimised.
Okay.
which is horrific. And I, you know, there's so much that's happening at Camp Sovereignty. People still need to have shifts. If particularly if you're a white, able-bodied man, like, come and show up. It's not enough to just, like, be, you know, quote-unquote progressive. Like, you have to genuinely be anti-racist, and you can't let Nazis attack sacred spaces like that. And I guess, you know, just to finish off, being there for each other, how do we kind of support better reporting and keeping up the fight, particularly through maybe the work that you do as well?
It's a tricky one, because I don't want to say pay for your journalism, but pay for your journalism. It's really hard and really challenging to, and a lot of work to go out there week in, week out, and go face to face with, you know, at times quite aggressive people, quite suspicious people. And I won't typecast everyone that I interviewed as that. There's a lot of people that were incredibly friendly, that were incredibly welcoming, that were incredibly willing to speak their piece. But it is exhausting work. And I'm, you know, I'm not just talking about myself, but there's a range of journalists out there. Pay for your journalism if you want good journalism, because the only people making money out here are mainstream center-right publications that feed off you know, hysteria and sensationalism, and far-right grifters that feed off donations from scared, you know, right-wing adjacent people. Yeah. So, yeah, if you want good journalism, if you want good coverage, pay for it. Otherwise, you know, do what you can to support researchers and journalists with any tips that you know about people, any information. And I think generally, you know, in order to combat this issue, it's more or less about uniting and coming together and deciding that neo-Nazi organizations like the National Socialist Network do not belong in this city. They do not belong in this country. And the only way to show force against them is through sheer size.
Yes, perfect.
They are not numerous.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's about all we have time for. I'm so sorry, Scooby. But thank you so much for a really important interview. And we'll be sure to link your journalism in the show notes as well.
Thank you very much, Nez.
Thank you. And that was Scooby McKay, who's a journalist, filmmaker, and youth worker known for his work under the only handle What's Doing Media. And his work focuses on political extreme far-right groups, youth justice, and political accountability. And we reflected on Sunday's March for Australia rally. It is the 4th of September and is currently 8:18.
And now we are going to an interview that I'm really looking forward to hearing. This is a conversation between my co-host, Zakia, and Mercel Sadat, who is the former captain of the only national level Afghan women's football team. So tune in and take a listen to that conversation.
Welcome to Current Affairs Show. I'm Zakia. Today we are checking back on a story that inspired so many Australians, the Afghan women's football team. After escaping Afghanistan, the players rebuilt their lives here in Australia. But football has always stayed close to their hearts. Now, the team isn't together in one place. Instead, the players are scattered, joining different clubs across the country. So, what does this mean for their journey as a team and their hopes for the future? To talk about this, I'm joined by Mercel Sadat, the former captain of the Afghan women's football team. Thank you, Mercel Jan, for being today in the show. I'm going to start with the question, how has life been for the team since coming to Australia?
Thank you so much, Zakia Jan, for having me. Before I get bullied for this, I want to correct that I'm a former captain of the Afghan women's team based in Melbourne when we were playing for Melbourne Victory, but not the Nationals. And life has been going good. For the past 3 years, we've been playing together as a team, which was amazing because we needed that. When we came here with no family, this team was the second family that we always had. And it was amazing to be able to play soccer, the only thing that made us feel like home, the only place that we felt like home and didn't think about any problems other than football. And as we went further, we had to transition into more of a national team level. because we were playing together and advocating for our right to be recognized by FIFA again. And it took us so long. And then we were like, let's just transition to more of a national team level where everyone plays in their own clubs with different levels. And then once a while, we come together in a camp, a training camp sort of thing, and train as a national team. And it's going good so far. Some of our players are playing NPL, which is a very, very high level of soccer in Australia, like the second best league. Some are VPL and some are State League One. And we have had the privilege to change history by convincing FIFA into creating a refugee team for the Afghan women's. For the first time in their history, they're creating a refugee team and opening this window for the Afghan women's team to play. However, it's not what we wanted because the title refugee has been always given to us. Like, it's already given to us since we left home. And our fight continues, and we need support in this term, and we need all the federation around the world to vote yes for a national team for Afghanistan from exile. Let's see what happens.
Wow, that's amazing. That's it's an inspired, like, you fight for your rights to call as a refugee players, and that's amazing. And what challenges have you faced playing in different clubs here in Australia?
So the first challenge would be finding a club, because when you're in a new environment in a new country, it's really hard, especially when English is not your first language.
Yeah.
For myself, it's been easier since after the first year of being here, I started learning English, adopting it from the community and working hard in my own time to learn it. I've never had the privilege to go and learn English academically, unfortunately. But then I made my way into like studying a dual diploma, and my teacher was very helpful there as well. The second challenge is actually, if you want to go to a higher level team, for example, NPL, at first you have to pay them. So that payment is a huge financial barrier for our players, because they're here not only supporting themselves, but they're supporting their family overseas, trying to bring them over, or if their family is here, they're the breadwinner. They're literally the parents for their parents. And yeah, it's a huge responsibility. You know, the crisis of living in Australia is raising day by day, and it's making it very difficult. So to me, the first challenge was actually like finding a team. And the next one was the financial barriers, until I found the South Yarra Football Club.
Yeah.
Which was playing in the State League One. And I applied through their social media link when they were advertising. And then I'm like, hey, I'm joining, but I have this 6 other teammates who wants to join as well. And they welcomed us with open arms. And South Yarra is the only club who is hosting the most of the Afghan players right now. And we just got promoted to VPL last week.
Wow, that's amazing. Like, you helped the team again to join a new club.
Yeah.
That's great. Regarding to the teams, do you still feel like one Afghan team, or more like separated players at the moment?
Well, at the moment, we always feel like we're one. We're never separated. Even if we play in different clubs, it doesn't matter. When we verse each other, so we're just friends, and everyone's like, aren't you guys opponents? We're like, nah, we're friends first and then opponents. So it's always a togetherness that makes change. And it's very important as women coming from a country where 70% of the community were against women playing sports. We always stayed united. And I think that has been the biggest cause of us convincing FIFA to give up and to actually pay attention to our team, you know?
Yeah. So
yeah, I guess it's just we're always together.
That's amazing. What do you see for the team's future in Australia or with FIFA?
For the team's future, we could have had a very, very brighter future, a different one than we will have, because we lost 4 years, which we could have represented our country and the women in Afghanistan. As we all know, women have been suffering there for a very long time, and we really need this platform. So there is no difference if we can't play soccer from exile and represent our country, or the Taliban who are not allowing women to play sports and represent their country.
Yeah.
So then it's both tough. Ways. Yeah, it's tough. And
it's tough to accept.
It's horrible that you have to suffer the same thing there and here. But and the fact that this year we were not included in the Asian qualifier games as a national team, it took another 4 years away from us. So for the next 4 years, Afghanistan will not be able to participate in any international competitions like World Cup or Olympics, which Wow. is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
However, we never give up. We tried our best, and the future I see for our team is bright still, because our girls are trying their best and they're putting their 100% and more to pave the way for the next generation. It's not only for the team based in Australia or for the girls who got evacuated from Afghanistan, but it's a fight for all Afghans who are all around the world. Maybe some of them do not have the refugee status to join the refugee team, but they're Afghan at the end of the day. Their nationality is Afghan, and they've always been dreaming of representing their country. They're very talented. So for me and my teammate, it's a journey of representation, it's a journey of advocacy and being a defender for the rights of all other women who can have a brighter future. Doesn't matter if one day the national team gets recognized, I don't really care if I'm playing on that team or not. For me, the important thing is that I opened up the pathway for others, and that's a biggest part of history. Like, being a history maker is pushing a very huge organization into deciding something that has never happened in their history, because we need it. Actually, we need that to be happening because of the Afghan women, because of the rights of people, because we will have a more larger platform to raise our voices and to push the world into not giving up on Afghan women, because they need opportunities. They're very talented.
They are.
Yeah,
they are. How can you learn more the team and follow your games?
So we all have social media accounts, and we have a social media account for the Afghan women's team.
Wow.
If you look it up on Instagram, you'll find it. And
feel free to mention your Instagram.
My Instagram is Marcel Sadat, and I guess it's Marcel Sadat 47, yeah. And the team's social media is Afghan women's team. So we're always active. We're always posting about what's happening next and what is to be done. And there are petitions linked in our bio to be signed.
Yeah.
And yeah, in this journey, which is very tough, and we felt lonely along the way, but then the community joined us, the politicians from around the world, the community itself by signing the petition, it's been really helpful. And we have built another community, a very bigger family. And we would like to expand it. We would like to invite everyone to join this community, to join the cause. And maybe later you can tell the story to your grandkids that, yeah, you know, once I did this, and that's why now these girls are playing.
Oh, lovely. That's so beautiful. And do you have anything to tell for your listener at the end of this interview?
The only thing I would like to leave them is to think about how they can make change and how they can create positivity in the community, how they can make people feel that they belong and they're welcomed. Because at the end of the day, humanity is over any race, any color, and any religion. It's the biggest thing that we can do for others. And the fact that peace starts within us. Once we start creating peace within ourselves, then we can spread it to community, and then we can spread it to world, so no one has to leave their hometown. No one has to leave their loved ones and family behind, because refugees are a product of war, and we don't want that happening.
Thank you for being in the show. Marcel Sadat, former captain of the Afghan women's football team, thank you for being the show and sharing your story and giving us an update on the team's journey. That's all for today's program. I'm Zakia, and you have been listening to Current Affairs Show Thursday morning on 3CR.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming